I have your Bible, 1 Corinthians 15. Let me begin reading in verse 3. Apostle Paul writes and says this. He says, "For I delivered to you as of first importance what I also received, that Christ died for our sins according to the Scriptures, that He was buried, and that He was raised on the third day according to the Scriptures, and that He appeared to Cephas, and then to the 12. And after that, He appeared to more than 500 brethren at one time, most of whom are still alive to this day, but some have fallen asleep. Then He appeared to James, then to all the apostles, and last of all, as the one untimely born, He appeared to me also. For I am the least of the apostles, not fit to be called an apostle, because I persecuted the church of God, but by the grace of God I am what I am, and His grace toward me did not prove vain, but I labored even more than all of them, yet not I, but the grace of God with me. Whether then it was I or they, so we preach and so you believe. Now, if Christ is preached that He has been raised from the dead, how do some among you say that there is no resurrection of the dead? But if there is no resurrection of the dead, then not even Christ has been raised. And if Christ hasn't been raised, then our preaching is vain, and your faith also is vain. Moreover, we have even found to be false witnesses of God, because we testified against God that He did raise the Christ, whom He did not raise, if in fact the dead aren't raised. For if indeed the dead are not raised, not even Christ has been raised. And if Christ has not been raised, your faith is worthless, and you're still in your sins. For those who have fallen asleep in Christ have perished. And if we have hoped in Christ in this life only, we are of all men most to be pitied. Now, if Christ has been raised from the dead, the first fruits of those who are asleep, now Christ has been raised. No question there. He has been raised. The first fruits of those who are asleep. It started for me about 6 years ago next month with an email and a question from one of our young people there at Kleinwood who was off in their first semester in college. They were taking a required religion course at the school they were attending, and their professor pointed out to them in class that there are serious historical questions about the authenticity of the text traditionally found at the end of Mark's Gospel in chapter 16. And so she sent me an email because she had heard the professor say that, and then she'd pull out her Bible, a mainstream translation. I can't remember which one it was, but nothing off the beaten path. And sure enough, there were asterisks and footnotes and brackets. And she had never noticed it before. Nobody had ever pointed out to her before. She was a fine young person. Good home, good family, devout faith, serious faith, a well-taught, sincere, high character. But there was a historical question that she had never noticed, never been pointed out, never wrestled with. And there she is, first semester of college, sitting in her classroom, troubled by this. And we had an exchange about that, and we talked through that, and we'll talk about that text in particular tomorrow night together. But I realized in that exchange that I had with that young person from our congregation, our own congregation, my work, that we were failing young people. The culture they've been raised in and that they will live their lives in has shifted so far and so fast to an explicitly post-Christian context that those of us who are even just a decade or two older than them have a completely different worldview and formative experiences than the young people among us today do. I mean, indeed, think how quickly the world has shifted. It's kind of like one of my high school students put to me here recently. It used to be cool for young men, and talk about in this high school, it used to be cool for young men to be promiscuous with young women. Now it's cool to come out of the closet. The world has always been wicked, but it's shifting rapidly in ways that I'm not sure all of us fully grasp. The questions that people wrestle with first and foremost have changed. The world shifted seemingly overnight. And we haven't always caught up with how to think, how to teach, how to defend, or how to form our young people in particular. It used to be that we thought that we just had to argue with our denominational friends and neighbors about baptism or about instrumental music or about the work of the church. Today, the first question is not how to understand or how to interpret the Bible. The first question is why the Bible at all? What makes it different? What makes it unique? Especially, it seems like every Easter or Christmas, there will be a PBS documentary or a Newsweek or Time magazine cover story that basically says everything you ever thought you knew about the Bible is wrong. And scholars now know better. And there's all sorts of historical evidence, historical issues with what we have always thought the Bible to be. We'll talk about that tomorrow night more specifically. But really, our whole point this weekend in calling this series The Lord of History is to focus on reclaiming not just biblical ethics, but a biblical worldview, a fully biblical worldview, to learn to think even more deeply in ways that follow the way the earliest Christians did. And so I'm thankful to the elders for their invitation to come and talk about these things here, because I do believe that they are necessary and becoming more necessary all the time. The fact of the matter is that brethren, churches, we've been able to piggyback off of a culture that at least in some way held some form of biblical worldview for a long time, but those days are over. And a lot of us are going to begin to discover very quickly how much we were actually piggybacking off of a somewhat Christian culture and weren't nearly maybe as effective in our teaching or preaching as we thought, or as I realized that day I got that email. That because the world has changed so much, we've been piggybacking off of the culture more than we realize, in terms of even just people accepting the Bible, even if we disagreed about what the Bible said. Those days are over. Those days are gone. And so I was, as kind of a beginning caveat, not just say that, especially tonight and tomorrow night in particular, these are kind of a little bit more lecture-oriented, less than sermon-oriented. We're going to be talking about history and how we know what we know and how we've gotten to where we're at with the Bible. It's a little more technical in nature. And so I'll beg your indulgence and maybe even your patience right now. I don't believe that everybody's going to get everything that I say tonight or tomorrow night the first time. There are recordings being made. But part of my real goal, part of my definition of success, especially in what we're doing tonight and tomorrow night, is this. If I can simply plant some seeds, even not everything sticks, not everything's comprehended the first time around. If I can simply plant some seeds, some ideas, and if nothing else, you walk away from here realizing whenever I see some documentary or some headline article saying that there are serious questions and possible questions that basically thwart or undermine or in some way conclusively prove that the Bible cannot be what it claims to be and that it does not say or really mean what it claims to say. At the very least, you'll realize that there is an alternative side of the story that's often not being told. Because you know what happens? Basically, nothing's going to, you know, it's not going to sell on the newsstands if the headline is, "Everything you always thought is true." That's not going to sell. But if everything you ever thought is false, well, now I need to get in on that. I need to find out what's going on. How have I been fooled? I don't want to be a fool. What do they now know? Scholars know that I don't know. There is always another side to the story that rarely gets played out in the media. It's funny, even as I watch PBS documentaries from time to time, what drives me nuts, knowing the academic side of these discussions and knowing who a lot of these scholars are that they put in the articles and they put into documentaries, what always drives me nuts is, even in the field, a lot of the people they go to because they're actually extremists, even among liberals in the field, but they give good sound bites. They say extreme things, and that's what gets people to tune in, and that's what gets people to buy issues, or in the internet age, clickbait. That's how it works. Even in the field, a lot of times, the people who are quoted are not the mainstream opinion, even for the liberals. They're the outliers. But they say astounding things, and they have the authority of a bunch of letters after their name, the prestigious chair they hold at a well-known university. And so they get the press. There's another side to the story. If nothing else, I want you simply to leave after these early sessions in this series, in particular, understanding that there is more to be said than is often said. But back to the first century now. Here's what you need to understand for where we're starting at tonight. Christianity, at its heart, is a historical religion. It's not so much the ethics of Christianity that make it unique. That's often what we focus on. Often when we teach our young people, we try to get the moral code into them, right? The rules, the thou shalt and the thou shalt nots. Promiscuous sex is forbidden. Don't lie. Don't steal. That's what we try to get across. And for a lot of us, maybe you've never even thought about it this way. For a lot of us, if we're not careful, our view of Christianity is Christians do right things and avoid wrong things. And you know what? That is true. That's just not far enough. Because you know what? When you stop and think about it, most major religious traditions in the world, think about this with me for a minute. Most major religious traditions in the world have the same, for the most part, same basic ethical code, don't they? Do Muslims think adultery is bad and forbidden? Yeah. Do Buddhists and Hindus think stealing and lying, you know, or that's not the right way, the right path to nirvana or a good reincarnation? Yeah. You begin to realize all of a sudden, ethically speaking, now, I know there's the golden rule, love your neighbor as yourself, but when I'm talking about big picture, broad brush here, ethically, what makes Christianity astounding is not that it says you can't sleep with somebody you're not married to, and you shouldn't be lying, stealing, or taking the Lord's name in vain. What makes Christianity truly different in the world is that Christianity starts not with ethics first, it starts with a historical claim. And what's that historical claim? God became flesh and dwelt among us, died on the cross, and most crucially, as we just read, on the third day, came back from the dead. And if you read 1 Corinthians 15, and many of you, you've been around long enough, you've read this passage before, you know what Paul's point is here. The cross, as crucial as it is, would just be a tragic tale without what happened on the third day. If the dead aren't raised, Christ isn't raised, Paul said. And if Christ hasn't been raised, you know what? Eat, drink, and be merry, because death's coming for the rest of us. Where Christianity starts, ladies and gentlemen, if you've never thought about this before, you need to understand this and get this kind of into the bottom and in foundation of your faith. Where Christianity really starts is with its historical claims. Because if Jesus has not been raised from the dead, the ethics don't matter. And if Jesus has not been raised from the dead, you know what? It is survival of the fittest. And so I'm heading for the parking lot before you, and I'm getting out of here. If Jesus has not been raised, if the historical claims are not true, we are wasting our times. And that by Paul's own admission, we are of all people most to be pitied, because we're chasing a fairy tale and wasting the precious few years that we have to exist. What makes Christianity special, different, is that it starts not from its ethics, but from what it says about history. That something a long time ago, or not so long ago in Paul's own day, but something happened. As Paul makes very clear, we're witnesses of it. We are bearing witness about what we have seen and know to be true. We are God's witnesses of what God has done in history. And if you don't have that, that history is not true and reliable, then everything else doesn't matter. That makes sense, everybody with me? And that's the crucial starting point. What makes Christianity crucial is the historicity of the resurrection. And we focus on the cross, but in the very real sense, Paul shows us that in the Bible itself, the real focus, we just often lose it, is a resurrection. So our question for tonight, our question right now is, basically, did it even happen? Did it even happen? Questions of historicity in the resurrection. To begin, though, as we get a little bit more specific, now I want to start with kind of a game for a minute. Sometimes when I do this, and I use this in a lot of different settings, sometimes when I do this in classes, we'll play a little game out loud with it. I'm not going to do this out loud tonight, but I just want you to play along in your own head with me for a second. I want you to read the paragraph with me on the screen. Clock on the mantelpiece said 10:30. But someone has suggested recently that the clock was wrong. As the figure of the dead woman lay on the bed in the front room, a no less silent figure glided rapidly from the house. The only sounds to be heard were the ticking of that clock and the loud wailing of an infant. All right. If you had to put a title, on that paragraph that describes what was going on, what that paragraph is about, just think for a moment in your own head, how would you title it? What's the title of that paragraph? What's going on? If that's the first paragraph in a story, what's the title of the story? What's it about? The clock on the mantelpiece said 10:30, but someone had suggested recently the clock was wrong. As the figure of the dead woman lay on the bed in the front room, a no less silent figure glided rapidly from the house. The only sounds to be heard were the ticking of that clock and the wailing of an infant. You got your title? Got what you think it's about? I mean, that was maybe a little bit of a murder, kind of got a little bit of a dark, sinister side to it. Well, if the title of this piece was Murlet Marplethorpe Manor, and you knew that when you started to read it, what would you see then? What would it mean? Who would the dead woman be? Well, she's probably then the victim, right? The victim. And the figure silently, mysteriously gliding rapidly from the house, who would that be? Well, if I'm thinking it's a murder mystery, I'm thinking that's probably the bad guy. That's, you know, whoever she or she is. I mean, that's who that is. And the wailing of an infant. Well, that must be the poor child, the woman left behind. Maybe the guy missed the baby or whatever. Murder at Marplethorpe Manor. But here's what's interesting. What if the title of the piece was The Birth of David Marplethorpe? Clock on the mantelpiece at 10:30. But who's the woman now? Well, that's probably a mother who died in childbirth. The baby was the one who was just born. That's probably David Marplethorpe. And who's the guy sliding quietly away? Well, maybe it's not nefarious at all. Maybe that's the doctor who's leaving quietly because he's frustrated he lost his patient. But here's the point, this little exercise to get us started this evening. The words on the screen never changed. But what you see in them does. On the basis of what? Well, on the basis of the title I put on the screen, maybe. Because if I'm a writer, by the title I put on the piece, I've already controlled your expectations of what you're going to see in that paragraph when you read it. I never change the words on the paragraph, but there are two legitimate interpretations possible. Depending on if I'm the author, I'm going to tell you which one is the real title. And I'm not going to do that. I won't tell you which one's real. You have to live with the ambiguity. No, but here's the thing. What this exercise underscores to us is this. If I didn't have a title, if I just had to read that paragraph, how would I make the decision? We make these kinds of decisions based on the assumptions we bring to anything. Based upon our assumptions. Here's my point. Scholars and skeptics will talk about where the evidence leads and where the evidence leads. But here's what you got to understand. There are facts and there are other interpretations. So I don't like people talking about, archaeology can prove or disprove the Bible. No, you dig stuff out of the ground. What you think about what you dug out of the ground depends on the assumptions you have about where you dug it up with and what happened in the past and things like that. You can look at the same thing and see two very different things depending on what your assumptions are about it. There are facts, and there are the interpretations of those facts. And depending on what the assumptions that people have are, two different people can look at the exact same thing and see different things. Hold that in your mind, the idea that basically there's facts and there's the interpretation of those facts. Keep that concept in your mind. We'll come back to that, and we'll use that when we conclude this evening. All right. So here's what happens. When it comes to the Bible itself, and at the end of the day, this is a historical religion. It's either historically true or it's historically not true. Number one, we need to understand what even history is. Most of us, history was maybe a subject we didn't like in school. We put up with it as long as we had to, and then we moved on. We didn't like it. And so most of us just learned what we had to learn. And for most of us, maybe history is a torturous memorization of facts and dates and names to be regurgitated on a test. And there's that one aspect of history. There are the facts of history, dates and people and places and events. But when you get in, especially if you ever did history in college or graduate school, or maybe you're just an amateur historian, you just like history, and so you go to Barnes & Noble or on Amazon.com, you buy books of history. Why is it that we have so many different books on, say, Abraham Lincoln? Do the facts of Abraham Lincoln's life change? Does his birthday change? Does how he died change? Does the date of his death change? Does the period of his presidency change? So why do we have so many books on Abraham Lincoln? Because there's lots of different ways to tell the story, because there's lots of different ways to interpret the man, right? Lots of different angles to look at, lots of different ways to think about it. And then among historians, even lots of different ways to argue about some of the more nuanced aspects of what his life was and what Abraham Lincoln really thought about different issues, about the power of the federal government, about the limits of presidential power. There's all sorts of ways to argue and think about that. But what historians do is they will take the facts, they will take the evidence, and then on the basis of maybe their assumptions, they will argue what they think ought to be the right historical interpretation of Abraham Lincoln. And that's the kind of history that comes to the point when we talk about the Bible's own historicity. But here's the thing about history. Too often when skeptics talk about the Bible can't be historically true, why do they say that? Well, because they've already got an assumption in play, don't they? What's their assumption? Well, That miracles don't happen. Well, maybe, maybe not. That's why we're having this conversation tonight. I wouldn't be here if I didn't think they weren't possible. But that's an assumption on the basis of which people will interpret, then, the facts that they have at hand. That's an assumption. Where do you get that assumption from? Is it reasonable to hold that assumption? Well, that's part of the conversation. But history at its root, you got to understand, and this is part of where we get into trouble as moderns, history is not able to be scientifically studied. What's the essence of the scientific method that we are all so acculturated to in our culture? And the scientific method is kind of the highest form of proving truth in our culture, isn't it? I mean, if science settles everything. We worship at the high altar of science in our culture. But what's the essence of the scientific method? For something to be truly scientifically provable or disprovable, it has to be repeatable. It has to be repeatable. Well, history, in the study of history, by its very nature, isn't repeatable, is it? We could bring Abraham Lincoln back and get a do-over on his life so we can get the history right this time. It's not how history works. History is not fundamentally scientific. And so when we expect, or when skeptics begin to sit there and say certain things couldn't happen, well, that's not exactly fair, because you're already making an assumption about what history is and what it isn't. History, by its very nature, is the study of non-repeatable phenomena. And what that means is that history, listen now, history does not allow us, by its very nature, to study it with the precision we are used to in our culture with a scientific mindset. And you know what? The ancients would have had no problem with that. It's only been since the Enlightenment, if you're familiar with European intellectual history, it's only been since the Enlightenment that people have had a problem with the non-scientific nature of the Bible. But the Bible, like all of history, is not subject to purely scientific verification because you cannot repeat history. And so I can never prove to a scientifically minded, a skeptic who has scientific assumptions, I can never prove, with that set of assumptions, I can never prove to his satisfaction the Bible. But if he's consistent, I also can't prove to him that George Washington lived. If he's truly consistent. Because how do I know that George Washington lived? Well, on the basis of artifacts that are left behind, his wooden teeth or whatever, documents that have his name on it, and on the basis of eyewitnesses who knew whom, who wrote their own things. But the problem is all those eyewitnesses are dead. And so how do I know it's not all a paper hoax? How do I know it's not all a hoax? Well, because that's not how we treat history, is it? There's enough evidence externally, and there's enough eyewitnesses of George Washington and his life and records left behind that we pretty much without question, even though none of us has ever met George Washington, though none of us in our own lives has ever met a person who has known George Washington, that's why virtually everyone in this room, though, does accept the fact that George Washington existed and that he lived, and he basically lived the life that we're mostly familiar with from our history books. When you understand how history is really done, you begin to realize that history by its very nature can't be scientifically proven. How do we do history of any sort? We look at whatever physical artifacts are left behind and we look at what eyewitnesses said about what happened. That's how we do history. Can that ever be scientifically proven in the repeatable sense that I can ever see this person? No. Anything that we know about the past at all, whether it's 100 years ago, 500 years ago, 1,000 years ago, or 4,000 years ago, everything that we know about history comes on the basis of the artifacts, physical elements that are left behind, and what eyewitnesses, those who were alive at that time, wrote or left about it. That's how I know anything. And the reality is nobody has a problem with the fact that George Washington lived and existed, because you know what? George Washington has never claimed to have parted the Delaware. He just boated across it. That's why nobody loses sleep over testing George Washington's life. But by its very nature, history isn't scientific, and it can't be proven by science. How do we know anything about the past? Because we trust what the people in the past said about the time in which they were alive, and we look at the physical evidence left behind. That's how we do history. And that's how it works. And so a frequently, uncritically accepted assumption is a bias against the unique, the different, the new in history. Think about it this way. In a very real sense, when we study history, why do we study certain names, and especially why do we study certain dates and certain events? We study them because something unique and different did happen on that day, right? It wasn't a normal day. What makes July 4th, 1776 different, or July 2nd, 1776 different? Because that wasn't any regular day, and what normally happens on any other given day didn't happen on that day. Why do we focus on history? Because something unique and different did happen. A bunch of men got together and at the risk of their lives, signed their names on a document and then promulgated it publicly that said that they were in open revolt against the King of England, and that they consider themselves to be free and independent men. History by its very nature, the defeat of the Spanish Armada. Here's the thing, you understand the nature of the defeat of the Spanish Armada, or even going back to our own Revolutionary War. How often in human history does a ragtag group of basically poor colonists overthrow the greatest power in the world in that day? It doesn't typically happen in history. But because it's unique, do I argue that the American Revolution didn't happen, or that we didn't win? Of course not. It did happen. I see the evidence of it. I read the eyewitness accounts that we won. I don't sit there and say, odds are, statistically speaking, that really couldn't have worked. There's just no way a bunch of ragtag colonists overthrew the well-armed, better-equipped, better-trained redcoats of a basically a country that ruled the world in that day or was on its way towards that. You get the point? History is often the story of things that are unique and unrepeatable and don't normally happen. The fortuitous events of the British defeat of the Spanish Armada, which ordinarily might not have happened, but the fortuitous circumstances of the weather and other factors play into the fact that on any other given day, the Spaniards might well have defeated the British, and history would have been very different because of it. But no historian sits there and says, odds are the Spanish shouldn't have lost, so we don't believe the stories that the Spanish Armada was defeated that day. That's not how history works. We don't sit there and say it's unusual or doesn't usually happen, so it can't happen, and other facets of history. So why do people have a problem with the resurrection of Jesus from the dead historically? Well, because we have an assumption that dead people don't come back to life. That's why people have a problem with it. But that's why the apostles and the early Christians did talk about it. They knew it was unusual. They knew that this doesn't happen normally. Every ancient people, you know, we get to be so chronologically snobbish sometimes. Even ancient people knew that dead people do not come back to life. You know that, right? The ancients knew that too. That's why they had funerals. That's why the Greeks burned their dead. That's why they wept and cried over it. Because they knew that once you were dead, that was it. Ancients knew that. At the end of the day, here's our problem. Here's our challenge, historically speaking. If a historian wants to play the real rigorous history game with the historicity of the resurrection, here's the challenge. At the end of the day, any historian worth his salt must explain why a group of first century Palestinian Jews began proclaiming at risk of their lives that Jesus of Nazareth had been resurrected from the dead. If it didn't happen, if something didn't happen, why would a group of Jews with nothing to gain and everything to lose begin to claim that Jesus of Nazareth, who everybody agrees was dead, that's never been debated. Everybody agrees, from the skeptics on down, Jesus died at some point. Why would a ragtag, insignificant band of Jews begin to claim that Jesus had risen from the dead? Well, here's the thing. Here's the number one. We've got to understand something. The Bible itself, understanding the importance, when the apostles who wrote this book, this New Testament, understanding the importance of Christianity historically, that the ethics, the morality of Christianity hangs on the historical truth of this. From its very beginning, when the New Testament itself was being written, always and repeatedly across authors, invited fact-checking. Let's get rid of that one. We're going to skip that one. Luke chapter 1, remember how Luke's gospel begins? Inasmuch as many have undertaken to compile an account of the things accomplished among us, just as they were handed down to us by those who were from the beginning eyewitnesses and servants of the word, it seemed fitting to me as well, having investigated everything carefully from the beginning, to write out for you in consecutive order, most excellent Theophilus, so that you may know the exact truth about the things you've been taught. Luke says, I did my homework, and Theophilus, you can follow the footnotes if you want to. Why do you have to rigorously research this thing before you write it? Well, because Luke believed the history mattered and wanted Theophilus to know that it's the history that counts. And that's why I checked. And again, it was eyewitnesses, people who had testimony to bear about what they'd seen and what they'd experienced. But it wasn't just that. It's sometimes even implicitly, Mark 15, verse 21. And so on Jesus' own way to the crucifixion, Mark records that they, the Romans, pressed into service a passerby coming from the country, Simon of Cyrene, father of Alexander and Rufus, to bear his cross. Why would Mark throw in that parenthetical, the father of Alexander and Rufus? Well, because odds are Simon was from Cyrene. That's modern-day Libya. Mark's gospel most likely was heavily published originally. This is another story for another time. But probably Egypt was one of the places that Mark's gospel most thoroughly got it spread around most quickly after it was written. Close to where Mark's audience was when he wrote the gospel for whom he was writing. In other words, what Mark's basically saying is, hey, you know these guys. They'll tell you this story's true, and this happened. That's why Mark most likely throws that in. Because it means nothing to us today. I don't know who Simon or Alexander or Rufus are, but the original recipients of this book may well have. Go and talk to them, because the history, the truth of this, the historicity of this matters. Of course, we've already read from 1 Corinthians 15, but notice again what Paul does there. He doesn't just claim that it's happened. Look at how he goes on to emphasize how many people saw this and can vouch for this. Cephas, that's an Aramaic name for Peter. Then to the 12. Then the 500 brethren at one time, and that's an important detail, because it means people were hallucinating when they saw Jesus, because you don't have mass hallucinations, not on that scale. And then he appeared to James. And then to all the apostles. And last of all, as one untimely born, he appeared to me also. What about this in Acts chapter 26? Again, because the ancients knew dead people don't come back to life. When Paul's standing before one of the imperial authorities, he says to Festus, Paul, because Festus thought Paul was nuts for what he was saying. Paul said, I'm not out of my mind, most excellent Festus, but I speak other words of sober truth. For the king knows about these matters, and I speak to him also with confidence, since I am persuaded that none of these things escape his notice. Look at what he says next then. For this has what? Not been done in a corner. There's witnesses, man. There's evidence to this. I know it sounds far-fetched. That's why I didn't believe it either for a long time. Remember, this is Paul we're talking about. I didn't believe it either for a long time. But at the end of the day, between the evidence and between the witnesses, I couldn't put it off any longer. I know it sounds nuts. I know you think I've lost my mind. Because you know why Festus thought Paul had lost his mind? Because they knew dead people don't come back to life either. It wasn't any easier to believe it then than it is now. Nothing's changed. In terms of human nature and what we all know typically or usually tends to happen. And so at the end of the day, here's the thing. When it comes to the historicity of the resurrection, very quickly, again, just to kind of plant the idea of how this really works, if you approach the history of the resurrection the way we do any other form of history, what are the artifacts and what do the eyewitnesses say? What are those who were on the ground? What they write about, what they think about, what they say about it, what do they leave behind? And what is the external evidence, the stuff that we have to look at and interpret on the basis of our assumptions? Well, here's the thing. The external evidence basically is the empty tomb. The empty tomb. Now, one of the things you've got to understand going into this is this. The Jews were looking for a Messiah. We all know that. The Jews were looking for a Messiah. And there were lots of messianic apostles. There were other people besides Jesus who showed up over the course of Jewish history and said, hey, I'm the Messiah. And you know what happened? You know what's interesting about that? Of all the other messianic imposters that happened over the course of the intertestamental period, Second Temple Judaism, both before and after Jesus, you know what's really interesting about them? They all died. And not only did they all die, some of them in violent deaths because they were trying to foment insurrection against Rome. Not only did they all die, but you know what's interesting? They stayed dead. Not only did they stay dead, but none of their followers ever then got together after they were dead and said, hey, he's back from the dead. And you know why? No other messianic attempt, no other messianic pretender, his followers ever made this claim? Because within all the misguided Jewish messianic expectations, and we've all read enough of the Gospels and heard enough about the historical background of the New Testament, know that the Jews had a lot of messianic expectations, much of them misguided. Nowhere in Jewish messianic expectation was the mark of the true Messiah ever to be resurrection from the dead. That's why Jesus had to spend so much of his time saying, hey, read the scriptures more closely. That's actually in there too. We know from Jewish writings, we know from contemporary sources that the Jews were not expecting a Messiah who comes back from the dead. That's why no other messianic imposter or pretender, that's why no that claim was ever made for any of the rest of them, even if his followers wanted to keep the cause going. Because it was not part of the way that you proved that you were the Messiah. It was utterly unexpected. That's why Jesus, again, had to keep pointing back to the scriptures and saying it's in the book. Because the Jews didn't get that out of the book. They had misread it, by and large. And so in other words, it makes it all the more astounding then. It makes it all the more astounding when the Apostle Paul, when he's on the Areopagus in Athens in Acts chapter 17, and he says to those pagans, beginning in Acts 17 and verse 30, when he puts it this way, when he says, therefore, having overlooked the times of ignorance, God is now declaring to men that all people everywhere should repent because he has fixed a day in which he will judge the world in righteousness through a man whom he has appointed. Okay, I'm with you, Paul, so far, but then notice what Paul says next in the very next line. And he has furnished proof to all men of this coming judgment. How's God furnished proof that this is going to happen? By raising him from the dead. Now, we take that for granted. We're here tonight because most of us are Christians. But you understand in the context in which Paul says that, not just pagan, but among the Jews, because he's a Jewish man saying this. A devout Jewish man throughout the course of his life always lived with all good conscience. Remember, Paul says that about himself. Always with all good conscience. Always a God-fearing man, even if he was mistaken at times. No Jew, no Pharisee, no Sadducee, no Herodian, no Essene, nobody in Jewish circles would have ever said on their own, in their own culture, in their own education, in their own upbringing, and their own interpretation of the Jewish scriptures up to that point. No Jew would have ever said that the proof of the Messiah is that God raised him from the dead. So if you're a sober historian, you've got to explain where that idea came from among Jews. Given that there was no expectation of it, and there's no reason that anybody, whether they were sincere or whether they were really trying to foment a hoax, there was simply no way that any Jew would have said, here's the proof, he came back from the dead. That's, if I'm trying to even perpetuate a hoax among Jews in the first century, that's not how I do it, because it would have made no sense to anybody. That's not how they read their Bible. So where, if I'm a historian, I've got to account for why Jews would actually think this is persuasive to anybody. Because we know, as Paul made clear elsewhere, I mean, you know, the Greeks think this is nuts. The Jews think it's pretty foolish too. Why would I ever, if I'm even I'm trying to perpetuate a hoax, let alone if I'm sincere, which means if I'm sincere, I'm going to just distort what I've already got. I'm not going to create something new out of whole cloth. This was never going to convince anybody, because nobody was looking for, in any way, shape, or form, a Messiah who raises, comes back from the dead. So where does it come from? If I am a sober historian, I can sit there and say, I don't believe that. That's not true. That's myth, man. That's just a fairy tale. We all know dead people can come back alive. Okay, that's fine, but I've still got to account for why and where did this come from then? Because no Jew in their right mind would ever push this as the persuasive point. Oh, by the way, here's how you really know we're true. Our Messiah comes back to life. And so let's just do history the way history is done in academia. How we do what we do with Abraham Lincoln, how we do what we do with Alexander the Great and everybody else along the line. How do we do history? If we're just going to be fair, if we're just going to be unbiased and balanced, how do we do this? Well, the empty tomb is our external evidence. It's the fact that must be interpreted. The empty tomb by itself, and here's the amazing thing about how God does this. God understands how we do history, how anybody has to do history. And that's why God leaves both of these things behind. Because if all I had was an empty tomb, all I would have is grave robbery. That's all I'd have. You know what? That happened enough in the ancient world. It wasn't that uncommon for tombs to be robbed in the ancient world. People left, then like now, leave valuable things behind. So we have to make it illegal in our own time. I don't know about you, but I worked a summer in a cemetery. I have no intention or desire ever going to be around that stuff. But if you want those valuables in those coffins bad enough, you just might do it. Ancient world was no different. The empty tomb by itself would be merely an instance of grave robbery, common enough. Empty tomb by itself proves nothing. Just means that either the disciples did try to pull off a hoax, or it means that somebody found the tomb and was hoping to strike it lucky. After all, we're told he was buried in a rich man's tomb. Everybody knows where the rich parts of the graveyard are. Appearances. If all we have was people claiming that they'd seen Jesus, and that's all we had, but not an empty tomb. Well, it's easy enough to write that off. Those are just people who are heartbroken and hallucinating. You ever know somebody who's under intense emotional distress? And they have memories that just really are kind of a little unhinged, or they think that they've seen somebody. I mean, I've been in the hospital with people before and had people told me they saw an angel the night before. That they've had Jesus talking to them. When people are physically ill or when people are emotionally devastated, things happen and people see things. Doesn't make it real. If all we had was claims of appearances by themselves, we just have a bunch of people who were hallucinating because they were heartbroken over the loss of the one who they thought was going to save Israel. But then you begin to look at what happens. Hallucinations that do occur with emotionally distraught people don't typically involve physical contact. They don't typically involve eating or drinking, as Jesus does in Luke chapter 24. Or as Jesus breaks the bread for those who travel with him on the road to Emmaus. Hallucinations don't rearrange your furniture. And I'll tell you, then, like now, the ancients weren't nearly as stupid as we like to think they were, or gullible as we think they are. The ancients knew the difference between the hallucination and the real world, just like we do. And furthermore, there's a difference. There's a world of difference in a hallucination where you see someone who has died, but that's why you're hallucinating about them, because you know that they're dead. And a hallucination where you see someone who claims to be resurrected. People who experienced hallucinations would say that they had seen the person. But you know what? Ancient world like modern world, no real lasting movement of any substance or any import that lasts comes from a hallucination, because there's no substance to it. It always falls away. People who are madmen who lead short-lived revolutions, it all falls apart soon enough. But here's, at the end of the day, the whole point is the hallucination is about a person who's dead, not a person who's alive. Hallucinations would be easily enough remedied at that by going back to the tomb and saying, look, man, get a hold of yourself. This is reality. He's dead. But here's the thing. At the end of the day, what do we have? We have the unassailable evidence of an empty tomb. And I'll say more about that in just a second. But we also have a lot of eyewitnesses. Individually, in pairs, and even as Paul makes it, a group of 500 at one time. And so what happens? Well, together, the empty tomb and the appearances, well, that's how we do history, isn't it? We have an artifact or artifacts. We have physical evidence. And we have people who say that, yeah, I saw it, and this is what it means, and this is what actually happened. Even though not every person confronted with this believed, enough did it, it tells us something happened. We have to account for why the group formed, why people got serious about this. And you got to understand this as well. When people talk about resurrection in the ancient world, when people did use, they had a word for this, they had a vocabulary for this. They understood that if someone's going to be raised from the dead, it involved a body, not a ghost coming back and talking to you at night. Resurrection involved embodiment. But here's the thing at the end of the day. Even non-Christian historians, when they look at the Gospels, they look at the evidence we have outside the Gospels from the first couple of centuries, even non-Christian historians have been forced to admit that whatever else you want to say about what happened, and there are several scholars who have come to this conclusion who are not Christians, that whatever else you want to say, the tomb must have been empty 2,000 years ago. Must have been empty. Because there's no other way, because of how we know that myths and legends are created, because of how we know that people hallucinate, because of what we know about how movements grow. There simply had to be something at root of it. The tomb must have been empty. Because whether you believe it or not, it wasn't just reported inside the Bible that the tomb was empty. The tomb was empty because in the second century, we still have a writer talking about to that day among the Jews, the rumor was that Jesus of Nazareth's disciples stole the body. But why to that day? Why did that rumor ever persist, not just in the Bible, something the Christians could have made up and stuck in there to prove their point? Why outside the Bible do we see that rumor verified? Because even back at the very beginning, everybody knew, regardless of what else you want to think about it, everybody knew that the tomb was empty. And so we've gotten to the point where even the honest secular historians admit that whatever else you want to say about what happened and what the Bible says happened, we have an empty tomb. The body of Jesus is missing. The body of Jesus is missing. Can't explain this idea otherwise. The Jews weren't looking for it. Nobody would have claimed the Messiah on this basis. Everyone would have claimed Messiah in a different way. There had to have been an empty tomb. Because at the end of the day, Christianity starts in Jerusalem. It starts among Jews. And it starts with a claim Jesus is raised from the dead. Because remember, the apostles aren't running around the day of Pentecost sitting there and saying, hey, change your ethics. They're sitting there and saying, God raised him from the dead on the day of Pentecost. That's their point. This man, Jesus, whom you crucified, God's now declared to be Lord in Christ. That's what they're saying. He's back from the dead. That's their claim on the day of Pentecost. We focus on baptism. Their focus was on, he's back from the dead. All that would have had to have happened was, no, his body is here. Why don't they do that? Because nobody had the body. The tomb was empty. And that's pretty much, for any reasonable person, an inescapable fact. That regardless, the Jews themselves know it, which is why they had to spread a lie inside the Bible as it's recorded, but outside as a second century writer will record it. That the disciples sold the Bible. Why did the Jews have to say that? Because the tomb was empty and they had no corpse. But not only that, then, when we go back to the eyewitnesses, well, but you know, maybe they were hallucinating. Well, here's the problem with that. Even the earliest Christians themselves, Paul included, acknowledged that they weren't expecting an empty tomb, nor appearances from him. Why were the women going to the tomb? Well, the Christians on the mission, why were the women going to the tomb on that Sunday? Spice up the body. What were they expecting to find when they got there? A body. Well, they found the angels in the empty tomb. They run back and they told Peter, John, the other apostles. And do Peter and John say, of course, silly women. That's what he said would happen. No, it's not what they say. What do? They go to the tomb themselves. Why'd they do that? Because they didn't believe it either. And go all the way down the line. What does Thomas say? Unless I see and unless I touch. Because you know what? He wasn't expecting it either. And you know why Paul was the last one in the fold? Because he knew dead people don't come back to life. And he couldn't believe it either. Until what happened to him? He saw a resurrected Jesus. Why would Paul convert? Why wouldn't Paul just have to say, you know, I really shouldn't have had that last slice of pizza last night? Because Paul knew the tomb was empty too. He just thought that he just bought into the lie, most likely. The disciples stole the body. He knew there was a problem. And now he's seen Jesus for himself, just like other eyewitnesses had said. See, the early Christians themselves all acknowledged we weren't expecting this either, because you know what? Second Temple Jews weren't expecting a resurrected Messiah. Wasn't part of the code. That's why nobody believed Jesus even when he told them. That's why nobody believed it even when it happened among the earliest Christians. And so after Jesus' death, the first Christians actually had to change their own minds because of the empty tomb and because of the appearances. It was not confirming their expectations. It was causing them to reorient their own expectations about who Jesus was, about who God is, and about how God works in history. The earliest disciples did not change because they had some sort of subjective personal experience, but because they witnessed an objective event. And not just one of them, and not just two of them, but all of them. Cognitive dissonance is what happens when people double down on previous beliefs despite the evidence. This is exactly what the earliest Christians did not do, because ultimately they could not deny the fact that the tomb was empty and Jesus just had lunch with us. And so the notion, and again, skeptics will sometimes sit there and say, because you've got to sit there and say, well, where did Christianity come from then? Because especially when you read the Bible at all and take it seriously, it says it comes from a confession first that the tomb was empty. Where, if I'm a historian, if I'm a skeptic, where then, okay, then you explain where Christianity came from, Mr. Skeptic. You tell me where this comes from. When the Jews aren't looking for this, they're not expecting it, the Gentiles aren't expecting it, and nobody in their right mind would have thought that would ever be the proof. The notion that Christianity grew out of early believers' subjective religious experiences and only over time later on developed into a resurrection belief does not fit with the evidence that the proclamation of the resurrection itself started from day one in Christianity. This wasn't one of those, and again, you watch a PBS documentary or something like that, what they'll tell you is the disciples eventually evolved in their belief to believe in a resurrection after, you know, enough time had gone by that there were no anyone who could possibly be an eyewitness left, and the beliefs and ideas got embellished, and resurrection came later. Because you know what happens? It's important that the words we start with tonight come in 1 Corinthians 15, because here's what you got to understand about 1 Corinthians 15. Even skeptical scholars, on the basis of historical evidence, understand that the book of 1 Corinthians, for all the doubt and skepticism that surrounds so much of the New Testament and academia, everybody agrees that Paul really wrote it, this guy named Paul really wrote it, and that it came from the 50s. Here's where I get to understand why that's important, because what's Paul saying in the 50s, as we just read tonight? That Christianity starts from the resurrection. And that there are lots of eyewitnesses even to this day of empty tomb and Jesus bodily walking around. I'm one of them. And you don't believe me? Go talk to Cephas. Don't believe Cephas? Find any of the 12 you can get. Don't believe them? Find one of the 500 who was there that time. Yeah, but there's a number of us walking around. Paul writes that in the 50s. Here's what you got to understand. Sociologically, anthropologically, the way legends develop, because you know we studied enough cultures, we know how legends develop. You don't, in the space of 20 years, which is within one person's lifetime still, you don't move from fairy tale to legend to this is what everybody believes. It's too short a time period. It doesn't happen in 20 years. Think about where you were at 20 years ago, 1995. Those of us who get to much of an age, that's just not that long ago. You don't create a legend that everybody falls for in 20 years because there are too many witnesses around. It's still too easily disproved, too easily challenged. Paul shows up at the wrong place in the timeline if resurrection is something that later Christians embellished or made up long after the fact. It was something that was said, it was something that was seen from the beginning. And so even from what we know about how legends and how cultures and religions develop in their myths and ideas over time, Christianity does not fit the pattern. If we would treat it the way we treat any other belief system, any other culture, any other religion, we would treat it fairly and understand that, well, something happened because from the ground floor, these people were convinced they had seen something and there was an empty tomb. And at the very least, then you also have to account for Paul's conversion itself, given that he was constantly confessing and making clear that he was vehemently opposed to Christianity. He was not a sympathetic believer prone to hallucinations because he was so heartbroken Jesus was dead, as Paul makes clear from his own mouth and his own hand. I thought I must do many things contrary to the name. I was a blasphemer because I was absolutely convinced that Jesus was the imposter and his disciples' frauds and phonies who should be severely punished. He was not a sympathetic believer prone to hallucination because he so desperately wanted to see his Lord and Savior alive again. He was a violent opponent who wanted nothing more than to crush Christians. So why does Paul think he saw Jesus? And so all of a sudden, we wind up with this. One of the most weighty books on the subject, written by a fellow named N.T. Wright, who was one of the world's greatest New Testament scholars of this era. Not somebody that I think we would recognize as a Christian, but somebody who takes Christianity seriously, and somebody who's a world-class historian in his own right, taught at Oxford, taught at Cambridge. He's no flake. He writes this. The early Christians did not invent the empty tomb and the meetings or sightings of the risen Christ in order to explain a faith they already had. Like I've said earlier, nobody expected, nobody thought to prove a Messiah on the basis of, hey, he came back from the dead. That wasn't in their DNA as Jews. That wasn't part of the Messianic expectation. They developed that faith because of the occurrence and the convergence of these two phenomena, which is how we always do history. What's the evidence and what do the eyewitnesses say? Nobody was expecting this kind of thing. No kind of conversion experience would have generated such ideas. Nobody would have invented it, no matter how ugly or how forgiven they felt, no matter how many hours they poured over the scriptures. That was why Jesus had to go over and over again. Remember what the Bible says sometimes? He opens their minds, he opens their hearts to it, because the Jews weren't connecting the dots from the prophets. And listen to what Wright says next. Again, this is no flick. This is a man who teaches at places like Oxford and Cambridge and St. Andrews, world-class universities. To suggest otherwise is to stop doing history and to enter a fantasy world of our own. A new cognitive dissonance in which the relentless modernist, desperately worried that the post-enlightenment worldview seems in imminent danger of collapse, devises strategies for shoring it up nonetheless. In other words, the modernist is the one who's ignoring history and engaging in fairy tale because he can't bear the consequences for his own worldview and how he wants to live his life if this is true. Because if this is true, it means Jesus is Lord. And if Jesus is Lord, we're all in a lot of trouble. The world's in a lot of trouble. And so I desperately, if I'm a skeptic and I'm committed to that worldview and those assumptions, I've got too much emotionally invested to disproving this and not believing this, no matter where the facts and the evidence lead, no matter how we do history in any other facet. If we treat this matter just like we do anything else when we do history, in terms of the kind of proof which historians normally accept, external evidence and credible eyewitness testimony, in terms of the kind of proof, man from Oxford and Cambridge, in terms of the kind of proof which historians normally accept, the case we have presented that the tomb plus appearances combination is what generated early Christian belief. In other words, why they started to believe is because this really happened. It is as watertight as one is likely to find. If I just do honest history the way I prove Alexander the Great and what happened and everything else from the past, even the distant past, I'm forced to admit that something happened in a Galilean hill 2,000 years ago that changed history. And change what history means, and change where history is going. Stories like these of the resurrection, with the kind of explanation the early Christians offered, make the sense they make within first century Judaism. But nobody within first century Judaism was expecting anything like this. Stories like these do indeed explain the rites of early Christianity, because the tomb was empty and Jesus was walking around and his followers saw him, ate with him, handled him, touched him. But they cannot be explained as the back projection of early Christian faith. Let me translate that. They cannot be explained as myths made up later as Christianity evolved. They cannot be explained as the back projection of early Christian faith, theology, and exegesis. Early Christians were not saying, as many critics have supposed, that the God in whom they believed had simply decided to perform a rather more spectacular miracle, an even greater display of supernatural power than they had expected. This was not a special favor performed for Jesus because his God liked him more than anyone else. The fact that dead people do not ordinarily rise is itself part of the early Christian belief. Why is it a big deal? Because this doesn't happen. Why, rightly understood, is this the ultimate proof that God is real and that Jesus is his son and that his gospel is the only way back to God? because this doesn't normally happen, which is why God gets our attention when he does it. The fact that dead people do not ordinarily rise is itself part of early Christian belief, not an objection to it. The early Christians insisted that what had happened to Jesus was precisely something new. They knew this is unusual. That's why none of them believed it initially. It was indeed the start of a whole new mode of existence, a new creation. The fact that Jesus' resurrection was and remains without analogy is not an objection to the early Christian claim. It's part of the claim itself. That's why we know he's the only begotten Son of God. Because God doesn't do this for just anybody. It's part of why we know that this is the one true religion. Because God doesn't normally do this. The fact that this is unique, unusual, almost unfathomable is not an objection. It is the proof that something is different about this religion. And so you sit there and say, okay, Jeff, that's great, and that's a lot, and my head's going to explode now, and I just want to go home and go to bed. It's been a long day and a long week. But all that being said, if it's that historically credible when we're fair with how we normally do history, even in academia, if it's that historically credible, as highly probable as case you can make with something that's not scientific, history, why is it then that so many people still don't believe? Why are there so many skeptics? Why are there so many academics, smart people with lots of letters after their name, who make their living on our tax dime in well-known universities, saying it couldn't happen, it's a farce, it's untrue? Well, because there's always substance and there's always facts. And there's the interpretation of those facts. Let's go back to where we started tonight as we bring this to a close. You've listened long. I've gone long. I thank you for that. Here's where we end. Go back to where we started tonight. What you see in the substance is all based upon the assumptions you bring to the task. If you've already decided that dead people can't come back from the dead, you know what? Nothing I'm going to say tonight is going to change your mind about that. You've already made up your mind. That's an assumption that you're going to hold on to. The assumptions that we hold affect what we see and around, all around us. And Professor's right point is maybe it's the modernists who really need to hold on to the fairy tale at all costs because they don't want to deal with a world that might be different than the one they've constructed around themselves. If Jesus is Lord, the world's in a lot of trouble. Some people got some splaining to do. If we don't, well, where do our assumptions come from then? From what we want to believe. From what we want, what we hope. If we don't want to believe that God is real, has ultimate authority over our lives, and has the right to tell me how I can live and what I can and can't do, if I don't want to believe that, then I'm going to find a way to make sure Jesus isn't Lord. I'm going to make sure to find a way that that's just a myth and a fairy tale. Well, you sit there and you say, well, Jeff, why does God make it so complicated? Well, it's not really complicated. It just takes some getting used to. But here's the point. Because God's wanting to test hearts. Are there people who will break their will, allow him to shape what they think about reality? Or those who will double down their own will, their own way? It's interesting. All the major prophets brought this point up. Isaiah did it. Jeremiah did it. Ezekiel did it. Seeing they don't see. Hearing they don't hear. What are they always getting at when they say that? It can sit there right in front of their face and smack them, but because it's not what they want to be true, they choose to ignore what the prophet says. Or they choose to ignore what Jesus says. Or they choose to ignore what God does with Jesus once he's dead. Because they see, they don't want to see. They look at the same thing that the apostles looked at. Empty tomb. Eyewitnesses saying, yeah, I just had lunch with them. It's true. Too many to be hallucinations. Something's going on here. And the tomb's empty. God tests hearts. That's what he's really doing. There is more than enough evidence for a person willing to humble themselves to God's ways, willing to humble themselves before someone greater, to believe that Jesus was raised from the dead. There is evidence and there are eyewitnesses, the same way we do all sorts of other ancient history. Incredibly so. But as Jesus himself pointed out in John chapter 3, you know why people don't come to the light? Not because it doesn't make sense, but because they don't want to come to the light because their deeds are evil. And the light will expose their deeds as darkness. It's will. It's not that it's intellectually impossible. It's will. There's more than enough here for a person who's willing to put the time and the effort, if you struggle with this, to look it all over, think it all through, and realize that there's a strong historical case to be made that the tomb was empty and Jesus came back from the dead. But if you don't want that to be true, any excuse will do.